91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with longtime journalist and National Geographic writer Willie Dry, who's written a definitive book about the fantastic growth of Florida and how expectations were often based on dubious premises. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Florida was a late American frontier, a 20th century promised land of sunshine, opportunity, and wealth. It presaged the new ideal of fun and wealth. Willie Dry has written For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold an Impossible Dream in Florida. Mass delusion, real estate busts, devastating hurricanes, and schemers shaped its reality. Florida's Impossible Dream, next with Willie Dry, after the news. And we're back on this rainy Monday morning. Joseph Cooper with today's topical currents. Bonnie Berman is just a little under the weather this morning or this afternoon, and we hope to have her back tomorrow. So the state of Florida was perhaps America's 20th century frontier. In 1900, the peninsula's southern half was sparsely populated by pioneers, yet ruled by mosquitoes. Those days, the only way to Miami, or Miami, was aboard ship. Then move forward 70 years, and humans rocketed off to the moon from Florida's Cape Canaveral. Then, by the end of the century, Florida teemed with millions of people who spawned the screwiest election fiasco in history. We're now joined by journalist and author Willie Dry. His latest book is called For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold an Impossible Dream in Florida. And he joins us from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Welcome to you, Willie Dry. Look forward to speaking with you.
Thank you for having me, Joseph. I really appreciate it. Sorry to hear about Bonnie. Hope she feels better soon.
I'm sure she will. We have a pledge drive starting tomorrow, so she'll be back in the saddle, I'm sure.
Need all hands on deck for that.
Of course. So, Willie Dry, what produced the 20th century atmosphere which made Florida so ripe for exploitation and a boom?
Well, for one thing, it was just a confluence of new technologies that enabled people to get the word out about opportunities such as this. But Florida was kind of a paradise waiting to be tapped. You mentioned that it was ruled by mosquitoes 115 years ago, and that is accurate. But anyone who has lived there any length of time knows the tropical beauty that you are surrounded by. It's just unavoidable. It's unlike any or few other places in the world. It seems like you're always within sight of a beautiful sunset, a beautiful beach, warm weather. So it was sort of waiting to be exploited. And Americans in particular, I think, seem to have a fascination with paradise, with finding a better place. Of course, it's a very human desire as well. But I think the new technology and the prosperity of the 1920s and the human desire to find a better place where you can live life comfortably all sort of came together at the right time. And that's what gave us the Florida land boom and the Florida that we know today.
In 1849, Californians were crazy for gold, or those going to California were crazy for gold, but they didn't have the technology the 20th century Florida had. Explain that.
No, they didn't. And of course, it's interesting that you mentioned the reference to gold. The rush of people that came to Florida in the early 20th century has been compared to the gold rush and in some ways exceeded it. The technology that I was referring to, radio was starting to come into its own. first radio stations were just starting to appear. KDKA in Pittsburgh and a couple of others were starting to appear. And now, as you and I are doing, we're sitting hundreds of miles apart and we're able to talk with each other. Before then, the link was just a letter or a horseback or a steam engine. New advertising techniques were emerging. Mass circulation magazines such as the Saturday Evening Post, Literary Digest, some of the other magazines like that were out there. And the new advertising techniques, much more aggressive selling campaigns. And then there was the end of World War One, which factored into it as well. World War One horrified people, and after 4 years of mechanized slaughter and millions of deaths, people wanted to have fun and relax. And some of the restrictions, some of the cultural restrictions, moral restrictions, whatever you want to call them, that sort of kept the lid on behavior, I guess you could say, in the late 19th, early 20th century, went away. And people felt more free to do as they pleased, to enjoy themselves. There was also the attitude about money changed. People started buying on credit, which would have horrified the Victorians to think that you were trying to buy something without paying for it in full. So these were some of the factors that came together all at about the same time to kind of open the door to Florida.
I'd like to spend just a moment or two talking about or going back to the 19th century, the late 19th century. You talk about the foreshadowing by, of all people, Harriet Beecher Stowe of promoting Florida. Of course, the little woman who started it all.
Right, that was Mr. Lincoln's reference to her. Stowe came to Florida shortly after the Civil War. Her son had been badly injured during the Civil War, and she wanted to find a place for him to recover. And so she came to Florida. At that point, Jacksonville was the largest city in the state. Miami was just a kind of a sleepy little outpost down on the Biscayne Bay. And she came to northern Florida and bought property near the St. John's River, and she was fascinated by it, fascinated by the tropical ambience, the jungle-like atmosphere, but also with just the beautiful, the wonderful climate that she found down there. And she compared Florida to kind of a beautiful but slightly disheveled woman. And she built a house down there and brought her son down and became quite a fan of Florida.
So in your book, Willie Dry, you speak of dreamers, schemers, visionaries, and themes. Give a little capsule of who you include in that.
It is quite a rogues gallery of villains and heroes, quite a lineup there. There is William Jennings Bryan is sort of a major character in this. I started to say novel. Actually, this narrative nonfiction. Bryan was considered a paragon of virtue and a great leader by many people. He was considered kind of a blowhard and a humbug by others. After three attempts at the presidency, three failed attempts of the presidency, he comes to Florida and becomes fascinated by it and eventually moves to Miami, gets involved in real estate there. Others who came there during this period, Babe Ruth was there for a while during the golden age of sports. Lots of other sports stars showed up during this period. Florida became the place to be. Gloria Swanson, the movie star, was a frequent visitor. Joseph Kennedy, presidents came to visit. President Harding really enjoyed coming down to Miami Beach and spending time at Carl Fisher's Flamingo Hotel. Even President Coolidge, who wasn't known to be a social gadfly, came down to Florida for a brief visit on the way to Havana for a Pan American conference. And of course, there was Al Capone, who was, by the time he arrived in 1927, his name was already a household word. So these were some of the big names that came to Florida. Journalist Arthur Brisbane was another one. Brisbane's name has just about been forgotten by early 21st century. But in his day, in the early 1920s, he was also a household word. He wrote a column called Today, published by the Hearst newspapers, that was, the audience was estimated at about 20 million people.
So was he sort of the Walter Winchell of his time?
In some ways, yes. He was a columnist for Hearst newspapers. He was also fascinated by real estate, and he was fond of introducing himself by telling people how much he made. It would go something like, hello, I'm Arthur Brisbane. Did you know William Randolph Hearst pays me $250,000 a year? That's how he would introduce himself. And he had an absolute fascination with real estate and became very interested in Florida property and became very good friends with a young journalist who is at the center of this book, a young newspaper editor named Edwin Menninger, who published the South Florida Developer down in Stuart, Florida. Menninger is sort of the Greek chorus of this book, if you will. He both participates in the action and then steps back and comments on it from time to time.
Getting back to William Jennings Bryan and his association with Miami and, I suppose, Coral Gables, it was sort of odd that he was this ultra, ultra conservative Bible thumper, and yet he wound up gravitating to sort of Sin City of Miami, the Sin City of Florida.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that, Joseph. The more I read about Bryan, the more of a puzzlement he came to, you know, he became to me. He was kind of this bewildering mix of progressivism and ultra-conservatism. On the one hand, he was an ardent supporter of prohibition and even went so far as to say that America should deal with the bootlegging problem. A lot of the booze in Florida was coming in from the Bahamas, which, of course, are just a fairly short distance from South Florida. Bryan wanted to force Great Britain to hand over the Bahamas as payment for their war debts to cut off the booze coming from the Bahamas to Florida. He was also a staunch advocate of not teaching the theory of evolution in public schools, and of course he was at the center of the famous Scopes monkey trial in Dayton, Tennessee, and was so he was a social conservative in many ways, but he was also very progressive. He supported women's right to vote, was an early supporter of that, and was also very much an advocate, a champion of the common man, and eventually his nickname came to be the Great Commoner. He did manage to find quite a home, quite a comfortable home there in Miami, surrounded by the centers. He became a real estate salesman for George Merrick, and became quite wealthy at it. He tried to downplay the wealth that he made. He said that he had basically just sort of stumbled on that wealth rather than obtained it through any shrewd business acumen that he had. But he was quite comfortable living in as you noted, the midst of the rolling good times in Miami in the mid-1920s.
Do you know about where that house was, the locale of it?
It overlooked Biscayne Bay, I believe. It was on Brickell Avenue.
Okay, Brickell Avenue. That was an early point of really sensational housing here in Miami. It's now the financial district.
I do believe though, Bryan's house still stands. Overlooking the bay, and he and his wife came down to look around sometime in the teens, I think it was. And Mrs. Bryan later said that the moment she stepped off the train, she was just captivated by the place.
And I was amused in the book, Willie, that you point out that Bryan was paid $100,000 a year by George Merrick, and that was higher than a higher salary than Babe Ruth in the 20s.
And it was also a higher salary than President Coolidge at the time also. So yeah, Bryan was doing quite well and One of Brian's most devoted enemies was the journalist H.L. Mencken. Mm. And Mencken often accused Brian of hypocrisy, and he, I don't remember the exact quote, but he accused Brian of basically raking it in with both hands.
While we're speaking with journalist and author Willie Dry on Topical Currents, we'll take a short break and be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, and we're speaking with journalist and author Willie Dry. We're talking about his latest book called For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold an Impossible Dream in Florida. Willie Dry, we were talking about, of course, George Merrick and Coral Gables and association with Williams Jennings Bryan. I know during that period in the 20s, in the late 20s, they began to have big band network broadcast, and some of them originated from the Biltmore Hotel in Coral Gables and featured bands like Paul Whiteman's and that to get interest. But in the book, you were also talked about the influence of film in the creation of Florida, of the new Florida in the 20th century, and that would include even the Marx Brothers, and it's always nice to talk about the Marx Brothers.
Well, I'm very glad you got us onto that topic. They were hysterical. They did a, the author, I believe, was Maury Riskin, if I remember correctly, who wrote a Broadway play about the insanity that was going on in Florida called Coconuts. And it opened to rave reviews in New York. The critics loved it. Time Magazine praised it and told readers that if they expected to get tickets, that they were going to have to wait quite a while because the lines were going to be long. And it was a really pretty vicious satire and hilarious satire of the Florida land boom. Groucho plays an unscrupulous hotel manager and real estate salesman who is pushing land at a fictional place called Coconut Manor. And he is joined by Harpo and Chico, who are a couple of hustlers trying to walk away with anything they can lay their hands on. And in between, of course, the usual Marx Brothers hijinks. The musical score was written by Irving Berlin. And that automatically, ordinarily, you'd think, well, that would mean that it must have had a great musical score. But Berlin lamented later that it was the only Broadway production that he had ever written the music for that he did not have a hit from. So somehow, I don't know if that was prophetic or what, but it was an oddity that Irving Berlin wrote the musical score and somehow managed not to come up with a timeless classic.
Well, let's hear a selection from Coconuts. Of course, this was an Irving Berlin song. The style of it is I find very odd, and the tempo. And it's sung by Billy Murray. It was recorded in 1926, but the movie actually didn't come out till a couple of years later, I think.
Right.
Willie, I'll let you outro this.
Joseph, thank you very much for digging that song up. It's perfect. I'm really glad you went into your archives and dug that out. And there, some of the lyrics in there, the style, you mentioned the oddity of the style. That's very much, though, a style of the times.
Sort of Rudy Valley-esque.
Exactly. That kind of warbling vocals by the male lead singer there, very much of its time. But it is kind of an odd song. But a few of the lyrics there talk about when it's freezing up north and it's July the 4th. Florida has always, that has always been Florida's tagline. That's always been its sales pitch. I noticed a couple of years ago when I was visiting my in-laws for New Year's up in New Jersey, and we were in Manhattan going into the tunnel, and I saw an electric sign and it was freezing. I mean, it was, you know, in the teens or 20s at that time, and I saw a sign that said it's 72 degrees in Miami. And they have been using that pitch, you know, at least ever since then. So that's classic Florida salesmanship there. If I may, I'd like to mention some of the one-liners that came out of that, out of Coconuts. Is that okay?
Please do.
Well, as I said, Groucho plays an unscrupulous real estate salesman. And one of the funniest scenes in the play and later in the movie was when they had an auction to auction off real estate in Coconut Manors. And one of Groucho's one-liners, of course, nobody lives in Coconut Manor yet because nobody has bought any property. And Groucho, and I can't possibly do the leering delivery that he does, so I'm just going to try to kind of quote it. Referring to Coconut Manor, he says, why, it's the most exclusive residential district in Florida. Nobody lives there. Another one that he delivers there, talking about the types of homes that people can buy. He says, you can get any kind of home you want. You can even get stucco. Oh, how you can get stucco. And so that's an example of some of the stuff that came out of there. I mean, it was the Marx Brothers' first movie, and they were still developing making the transition from stage to screen. But it is, it's still one of my favorite movies for obvious reasons.
It's odd with all the subdivisions and developments that we have. Perhaps there is, but I'm not aware of it. I don't think there's anything called Coconut Manors here. You think someone would have come up with it?
I don't think so. I think you're right.
One of our listeners will probably call in and tell us where it is, but you would think they would have come on that. Let's talk more about the development of Florida. The 20s were such a boom nationwide, and especially in Florida. But then 26 and 28, and weather becomes a major factor here. And tell us how it affected especially South Florida. And of course, the 28 Central Florida, the Lake Okeechobee area.
Yeah, hurricanes played a major factor in the way that the boom played out. I write about both of the 1926 and the 1928 hurricanes, which are sort of a murderer's row of hurricanes there, two of the most infamous hurricanes in American history, and both of those storms are fairly well known by anyone who's lived in Florida any length of time. And I'll talk just a little bit about them. I also sort of want to lay down a marker here, if I could. I want to talk very briefly about a couple of other hurricanes as well, because the 20s were a fairly active period, fairly active summers. So there were several other hurricanes that played a role in what happened. The 1926 hurricane, when it came ashore on September the 17th, I think it was, 1926, the eye came ashore at Miami Beach. At that time, that was the most powerful hurricane to make landfall in the U.S. And it devastated Miami Beach, sent a storm surge over Miami Beach and sent seawater into downtown Miami. The winds were estimated variously, I think at 145, 150 miles an hour at times. There was an author, a real estate salesman named Leo Reardon, who wrote a wonderful book about his experience in that storm. And I quote extensively from that book. He wrote it out in Coral Gables with his family. Talking about other hurricanes that had some influence on it, there was also a hurricane in July of 1926, very powerful storm. Could have easily, well, it did make landfall actually near Miami, but it weakened considerably. It had winds upward of 150 miles an hour when it affected Cuba, but it weakened considerably by the time it got to Miami, and the winds were down to around 80 miles an hour. And the reason that that was a factor is that with all of the newcomers in Miami, they had heard about these things called hurricanes. And of course, they were aware that one was coming in July of 1926. But when it turned out to be really not very much of a storm at all, well, they thought that they had seen the worst that nature could throw at them. And so they probably didn't adequately prepare for the real monster that came around a little bit later. After the 1926 hurricane, people, of course, were on edge. The city was in shreds. And there was a prankster by the name of Charlie Haynes who decided that it would be a lot of fun just to stir up a little more anxiety among Miami residents. So Charlie went running through hotel lobbies yelling that another hurricane was coming. And of course that freaked everybody out. Women broke down in tears. Some men reportedly fainted. They finally chased Charlie down, and I think he got 90 days on the chain gang for that little episode. After that, in October of 1926, another very powerful storm formed down near Cuba, came across Cuba. Looked like that it was headed straight for Miami, and people again were scared to death, and a lot of people started leaving town. It really devastated Havana. I think it hit Havana with 150, 160 mile an hour winds. One of the witnesses said that dead cows were dropping out of the sky. But at the last minute, Miami got lucky again and the storm veered away. And Key West got 100 mile an hour winds, I think, but Miami again got lucky and got only 80 mile an hour winds. And people were so relieved that there was a spontaneous celebration in downtown Miami when they took down the hurricane warning flags. You mentioned the 1928 hurricane. That was, if you can imagine, it was even worse than the 1926 hurricane.
And the biggest killer in state history.
Yes, sir, it was. And still second only, I think, 35. To the Galveston hurricane of 1900. As the biggest killer of in Florida history, and they didn't even really know how big it was. The death toll, they didn't really know how big that was until some years later. I think they initially estimated it at around 1,800, and then not too long ago, a few years ago, they found more evidence and did a little more research, and a friend of mine, Elliot Kleinberg, wrote a book that mentioned this about this hurricane. And I think that they upped the estimated death to somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000.
Yeah. There were a lot of African-American farm workers that were drowned in that.
Right. In those days, migrant workers were not Spanish descent, Hispanic descent. They were African-Americans or, in some sense, Caribbean Africans, and there were thousands of them that came to that area to harvest the bean crop and other crops. They were undocumented. They were paid in cash. Nobody knew. There was no registration. You just showed up, went to work, and got paid in cash and moved on to the next job. And the storm came in at West Palm Beach, and it was even more powerful than the 1926 hurricane. And usually when hurricanes come ashore, they start weakening. But the summer of 1928 had been so incredibly rainy And there had been a hurricane that had also come ashore up the coast in August of 1928, came ashore at between Vero Beach and Fort Pierce. And it was a fairly powerful storm, but it was also a very wet storm. And so Lake Okeechobee had been filled to just dangerous levels. So this was basically a disaster waiting to happen. The only thing holding back the lake was a very flimsy dike made of muck. And when the storm came ashore, as I said a moment ago, usually hurricanes weaken when they come ashore. But the summer of 1928 had been so wet and rainy that much of the area between West Palm Beach and Lake Okeechobee was flooded. And I talked with several meteorologists about this. I came across the theory during my research that one of the reasons that the hurricane was so powerful when it reached Lake Okeechobee is that even though it was inland, it was over floodwaters, and that allowed it to at least retain much of its monstrous strength as it went inland to Lake Okeechobee. And when it reached the lake, it pushed a big, huge wall of water against that flimsy dike, and the dike gave way. And the moment that dike gave way is just wonderfully described in Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. If you haven't read that book, I would highly suggest that you do. But her description of what happened when that dike broke is just remarkable. Belgrade and Pahokee. Moorhaven was the 1926 hurricane. Right. And if you go to Belgrade today, you will see, I think I'm right. Am I getting them backwards there? I believe it's Belgrade. You see the there's a statue there that was done during the bicentennial of a family fleeing the storm. Very powerful. But as I said, Zora Neale Hurston gives the best description of what happened when that dike broke that I have ever read.
Speaking of famous Florida authors at this time, of course, everyone associates Marjorie Stoneman Douglas with Everglades River of Grass and her efforts there. But also in the era we're talking about, she wrote great short stories about the Binder Boys and such in Miami at that time. Tell us about that Depression era of the real estate that was centered in Miami. And those listeners who want to catch up on those really get another view of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas there.
The Binder Boys have been blamed by some people as being the cause of the land boom getting overheated and collapsing. They were ambitious, usually young men, but there were a few women involved. Ambitious people who came to South Florida for the sole purpose of making as much money as they could off of the real estate. They had no intention of buying and keeping it. They were the ultimate real estate flippers. And they sort of stripped the real estate speculation process down to its barest essentials. They would sell binders that buyers had no intention of ever paying off. But whoever bought the binder, usually for something like a 10% down payment, the buyer would then turn around and sell that to someone else at a vastly inflated profit. And the payments were not due for 30 days, 60 days, and it was not unusual by the time the payments became due that the binder had changed hands dozens of times. And it was the Binder Boys were often described as kind of small, slightly grubby individuals. They often wore knickers that were called plus fours because they extended 4 inches below the knee, and were sort of bloused there, and they wore knee socks, and often wore a kind of a dirty sport jacket of some sort, and were often sporting the wide-brimmed round straw hats that were referred to as boaters. And they descended on Florida. They were described like, some people described them like a swarm of locusts. In 1925, they were not there for a real long time. They slept wherever they could. It was almost impossible to find a place to sleep in Miami at that time, and they sometimes even slept in shifts. They enhanced their sales techniques in the evenings. Often you would see them moving slowly down Flagler Street, and they would be accompanied by couple of jazz musicians who would be playing very softly in the background while they walked slowly down the street, calling off real estate that they had available. And it was it really overheated the speculation. And as I said a moment ago, a lot of people think that that may have been what caused the eventual collapse of the boom, that they drove the prices up so high that they could not possibly sustain that. Eventually, the Binder Boys disappeared because tax laws were changed so that when they started, you did not have to pay taxes, right? You only paid taxes on the cost of the binder. In other words, if I sold you a binder for $1,000 on a piece of property that was valued at $10,000, I only had to pay taxes on the $1,000. But they later changed the tax laws so that if I sold you a binder for $1,000 on a property that was valued at $10,000, I had to pay taxes on the whole $10,000. So that pretty well put the skids on the Binder Boys, and they started leaving town. You know, they had barely been there a year, I guess, when these changes were made, and they were probably all gone by about 1926.
We're speaking with journalist and author Willie Dry about his latest book, For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold an Impossible Dream in Florida. Willie, in just a minute or two, could you break us down? You mentioned Al Capone living on Star Island here between right. Miami Beach and Miami. And also one of his, I wasn't aware of this, one of his associates or of some sort, the killing of Fatty Walsh at the Biltmore Hotel. Take us back to that time.
Sure. Al Capone came to Miami in 1927. The boom, of course, was starting to slide, but nobody, the point that I tried to make in the book was that even though the boom had started to decline and would not come back, people didn't know that. They didn't really know that that's something that was only realized in retrospect. But Capone came to Miami. He told people that his name was Al Brown and that he was a used furniture salesman, and he had apparently done quite well at his profession. After he had been there for a while, he decided he liked the place. He wanted to stay. He stopped using an alias. He made a public announcement, "I'm Al Capone and I'm living in Miami now." And he rented a suite of rooms at the Ponce de Leon Hotel. At that time, the Ponce de Leon was managed by a young man named Parker Henderson Jr., who was the son of a former mayor. Parker was in his mid-20s. He was also kind of quite taken by the style and the influence of a man like Al Capone. And Parker became sort of his gopher. And he started running errands for Capone around Miami, where it really wasn't a good idea for Capone maybe to show his face. One day, Capone asked Henderson to go buy some guns for him and gave Henderson a wad of cash. And Henderson dutifully trotted off to a hardware store, came back with some guns, and so in the meantime, one of Capone's rivals in Brooklyn, a guy named Frank Uali, whose street name was Frankie Yale, had done something to greatly annoy Capone, and Capone decided that it was time to eliminate him. So on a July afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, in 1928, a carload of assassins caught Uali on a street in Brooklyn and gunned him down in his car, and then drove away. Uali was dead before his car came to a stop, and The gunman abandoned the car a short distance away in a cemetery. Police, of course, later found the car. They found guns in there that had been used. And, of course, they started investigating. Well, one of the guns that they found in the car happened to be one of the guns that Parker Henderson had bought for Al Capone in Miami. So Parker had some explaining to do after that. But eventually cops decided that he had not been involved in the murder, that he was kind of a dope for getting, for running Capone's errands. To get to Walsh, in 1928-29, Walsh, who came to Miami, he was at a party in the Miami Biltmore, the Biltmore, and they were some he and his friends had rented two sets of rooms there. Walsh was fond of bragging that he had been the bodyguard for Arnold Rothstein, who had fixed the 1919 World Series. Apparently, Walsh was not a very good bodyguard because Rothstein did get killed himself. But Walsh was at this party. They had rented two adjoining rooms, maybe 20, 30 people in there, young men and young women, very stylishly dressed, playing cards. All of a sudden, a door opened and a gunman stepped in and shot Walsh, killed him. Also happened to wound someone sitting near him who did not think that he had been the target. He was just a friend who had been there playing cards, and he just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. But this was when police investigated this, they found out that that this may have been someone getting revenge for Frankie Yale's killing in Brooklyn. So these tentacles of organized crime were starting to reach out, and Miami was starting to get identified with some pretty serious gangsters.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll resume our conversation with journalist and author Willie Dry. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman is a little under the weather today. And we are talking with Willie Dry, a historian, journalist, and author. We're talking about his book, For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold an Impossible Dream in Florida. Willie, keeping with this theme of the tantalizing aspect of 20th century Florida and its realities, tell us the story of Addison Meisner and Boca Raton.
Addison Meisner was a real showman in a lot of ways. He's a fascinating character. In the winter of 1924, I think it was, he was freezing to death in a little apartment up north. I believe it was in New York City or one of the suburbs. And he became friends with past Singer. And Singer said, we should really just go down to Florida where it's warmer and maybe you'll do better down there. So they came down to West Palm Beach, that area, and Meisner was a genius in his own way, and he started designing homes and interiors and so forth that were just, they were beautiful, they were popular. And he brought in his brother, Wilson Meisner, who was a real scoundrel, a real colorful scoundrel, probably a very likable guy, but didn't have a lot of boundaries when it came to, when it came to selling real estate. And so Wilson and Addison were raking in millions of dollars. Their catchphrase, very private catchphrase. Publicly they said that Boca Raton was a place with every atom of beauty that nature can provide. But privately, their sort of private catchphrase was, get the big suckers and the little suckers will follow. And they put together an all-star board of directors that included T. Coleman DuPont, U.S. Senator and a general, also included Jesse Livermore and other blue-chip names in American finance. Addison was fond of saying that the Boca Raton was simply too well financed. There was too much money behind Boca Raton for it to possibly fail. Of course, those words kind of echo in 2015 as we look back on what happened 6 or 8 years ago. But that was Meisner's, one of the ways that Meisner sold his property. He presented beautiful sales brochures, and he was bringing in millions of dollars. And his brother Wilson often would stage events. One of the things he did, I believe, was take some phony treasure out to Boca Raton Inlet at night and dump it there, and then stage the discovery of the treasure the following day for journalists. but eventually, Addison and Wilson went too far with some of their claims. DuPont was really concerned about some of the advertising claims that they were making. And rather than, he tried to get the Meisner brothers to rein in some of their rhetoric, but they refused to do it. So DuPont resigned. And Addison made the very stupid mistake of saying that Coleman DuPont had resigned because he couldn't get his cronies on the board of directors. Well, of course, Mr. DuPont didn't like that very much, and nor did other members of the board of directors, including Jesse Livermore, who was a big name in finance at that time, and they resigned. And this, of course, made public newspapers and became national news, and that really started the Meisner brothers down the road to failure. Eventually, they became bankrupt, and they were sued for millions of dollars. And when the bankruptcy audit was done, I think they had something like $56,000 worth of assets and millions of dollars in bills and that were due. So they really, of course, it's Addison had a good idea. I mean, Boca Raton today is one of the most beautiful cities in Florida. But he was a little too exuberant, I guess, getting it off the ground.
Also, as things burst the bubble of Florida, it seems even the insect pests piled on, the Mediterranean fruit fly epidemic. I know in the 70s it caused the lethal yellowing of all the palm trees. But before we have to close the program in just a minute or so, tell us a little bit about the fruit fly epidemic in those times.
Well, just when it looked like things couldn't get any worse, they did. Fruit flies started showing up in the citrus groves, and this, of course, was a disaster. The Mediterranean fruit fly is one of the most, they can just devastate a citrus crop. They feed on the pulp, and it makes the fruit, of course, totally worthless. And they were discovered, I can't remember the exact date, I'm thinking 28, 29, something like that. And so there was an all-out effort to try to eradicate the fruit flies. One of the things that it did do, was to give employment to a lot of people who were by now out of work from the land boom in the eradication program that the federal government set up and the state of Florida set up. And they actually set up checkpoints at the roads coming into Florida to check people for if they were bringing in any fruit flies. There was speculation that the fruit flies, people were wondering how the fruit flies got into Florida, and there was speculation that they had come in on straw that had been used to protect bootleg whiskey, which, you know, was a nice little bit of irony there. But one, as I said, one upside was that it did give work to people who badly needed it. And another, I guess you could call it positive aspect of it, at the checkpoints coming into Florida, they were able to tell that people were still coming to Florida, that in fact records were being set because they were tabulating all these people who were coming in at the border. So people were still very much interested in Florida.
Well, it's certainly been an interesting hour, Willie Dry. It just seemed to fly by for me. Journalist and author Willie Dry, his latest book is called For Sale, American Paradise, How Our Nation Was Sold, An Impossible Dream in Florida. Thank you very much, Willie Dry. We hope to have you back soon.
I hope I am back soon. Thank you very much for having me. And thanks to my engineer, Russ Henry at WUNC. It's great to be back home at my old alma mater in Chapel Hill.
And on our side to Paul Leary. And we hope you enjoyed today's Florida segment. It was produced by Richard Ives. Again, technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. If you'd like to hear it again, or hear it in its entirety, or send it to another person, simply download an audio archive from our website, WLRN.org. You can also click for more information on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you will. Tomorrow's program is another in our friendly fundraising repertoire. It's Members Only, where Bonnie and I chat with loyal WLRN members. If you're in good standing, feel free to tell us about what made you become a friend and a member. Joseph Cooper here. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.